A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
You pop-crazed youngsters, and welcome to part two of episode 72 of Chart Music. Here I am, Al Needham, and standing with me are Simon Price,
Shemai,
and David Stubbs.
How do?
Chaps, we've walked down 1985 Street a couple of times before on Chart Music, and yes, we have been surprised every now and again by the quality of some of the tunes on offer, but 1985 is always going to be remembered as the year pop was expected to pitch in and solve the problems of the world instead of just being any good like it used to be a couple of years previous.
Yeah, there's a sort of debilitating earnestness, definitely, on all fronts. Mm.
It's a waste of time if you know what they mean. Try shaking a box in front of the Queen, as Paul Heaton of the House Martins sang about what had happened to pop around this time. You know?
Yeah, I mean, if you ask people what happened in 1985, you know, Live Aid's probably going to be the first thing that comes out of their mouths, or at least the only good thing after, you know, Heysel, Valley Parade, all the plane crashes, the Mexico City earthquake, AIDS, the end of the miners' strike. And you could say that this is a year that pop gets pushed into growing up and being responsible for a few years, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also, I think, that with Live Aid, it's almost like the old order returned to sort of see off the last vestiges of like post-punk and all that kind of thing, and that kind of sort of fractiousness and scrappiness. Mm. Yeah, I always think that Live Aid, in a funny kind of way, was a sort of precursor to things like Rave, then later on Oasis, this idea of us all being together.
Mm. Yeah.
And after the kind of tribalism, the fragmentation of the 1980s.
Yeah, that's the thing, you know, piling everybody together in a massive stadium to all watch a load of pop groups that we all agree on. 4 years earlier, that would have been unthinkable. You'd have all the sort of all the mods and the Teds and the Skins and the Rockers and stuff just having a massive fight.
Fucking hell,
no, by 85, no, we'd all grown out of that, and we're all together. Yeah,
yeah.
Everyone's in their Choose Life t-shirts, and everyone's responding to Deo from Freddie, and it's just one big loving.
Mm.
Too many Florence Nightingales, not enough Robin Hoods, to quote the House of Martins yet again. Mm. Yeah,
Live Aid a few years previous would have been the opening scene of The Warriors, wouldn't it? With more Parkers. Somebody shot Bob Geldof. It was the Warriors.
Come out to play, yeah.
All right then, pop craze youngsters. It is time to go way back to October of 1985. Always remember, we may coat down your favourite band or artist, but we never forget they've been on top of the pops more than we have.
For the very first time to Paul Jordan.
Thanks very much indeed, Gary. Have we got a great show for you?
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday evening, October the 3rd, 1985, and Top of the Pops, about to broadcast its 1,123rd episode, has spent the year adopting to the choppy waters of the Michael Grade Reformations. After beginning the year ensconced in its usual post Tomorrow's World slot, enjoying the 40 to 45 minutes it deserved, it was all change in late February when the timescale was chopped to a rigid 30 minutes in order to accommodate the launch of EastEnders, whose first episode pulled down 13 million viewers, which wasn't that brilliant in 1985. Desperate to get his flagship drama series into the top 10 of the ratings, Grade mashed up the schedule, moved EastEnders to 7 p.m. and pulled our favourite Thursday evening pop treat up to 8 o'clock, which saw the former drop to 8 million as it was in direct competition with Emmerdale Farm, and the latter lose its faction of pop-crazed extremely youngsters who needed to go to bed at a decent hour, especially on the last Thursday of June when Top of the Pops didn't start until 8:30 p.m. Upset that his bi-weekly slab of Cockney misery was losing viewers to rural issues, Grade shuffled the deck again, and on September the 3rd, Top of the Pops began at 7 p.m. as the prelude to whatever was going on in Albert Square that week, a format that would stay in place for the next 11 years before it was dumped into the Friday evening schedules. Long story short, chaps, Top of the Pops has been fucked about within 1985. That's not right, is it?
It definitely isn't. And EastEnders is another thing, you know, like Live Aid, ruined everything, ruined soap.
Ruined Top of the Pops.
It ruined Coronation Street. Coronation Street felt like it had to get more miserable in order to kind of keep pace with EastEnders, and started having kind of stupid, spurious kind of character shifts and regular characters turning out to be wife beaters after about several years, you know, all that kind of nonsense. Yeah, EastEnders ruined everything. And Top of the Pops.
And it's just really thoughtless of them to hack it back to 30 minutes. How are we meant to get 7 hours of podcast out of a mere 30-minute television
program?
You
know what I mean?
It can't be done.
Yep, absolutely, yeah.
Have I said this before? I used to own Michael Grade's computer.
What?
Yeah. When I bought my first personal computer in the 90s, Apple Macintosh LC2, I got it from a company in Reading called Second User Mac Systems, who had somehow got hold of a load of old Channel 4 stock, clearly.
Right.
And I expected all the discs to be wiped and everything, but I plugged it in and started looking about. And yeah, it had previously belonged to Michael Grade. And I was like,
whoa.
I know. I was so excited, thinking I might find something, some dirt that might, back up Chris Morris's famous interstitial subliminal frame that said "Grade is a cunt."
Was that a screensaver?
Yeah. Sadly, and really boringly, all that was on there was a load of folders with plans for Channel 4 schools programmes.
No,
I know, I know. I thought there was going to be some real juicy stuff on there, but no. But yeah, that's my claim to fame, my link to Michael Grade.
Furthermore, after 24.5 million people in Britain sat in front of the telly for Live Aid, which was the biggest television audience of the year in the UK in 1985, it's beginning to dawn upon the television industry that folk rather like watching music TV, and they want more of it, meaning that Top of the Pops is no longer the only game in town. The new series of Whistle Test started last Tuesday. Billy Idol, Squeeze, The Long Riders and John Parr. Channel 4 is putting out the final episode of Bliss, presented by Muriel Gray, with performances by Sade, The Cult and Jesse Ray, with King Kurt modelling the latest in cycling gear. And Soul Train, with Jeffrey Daniel introducing Loose Ends, Ashford and Simpson and The Stylistics. The new series of The Tube kicks off next Friday with Pete Townsend, Dex's Midnight Runners, Depeche Mode, The Thompson Twins and Madonna, but the big event of this week musically happened on Tuesday night on ITV when the white-hot sounds of the mid-80s clashed with the cold realities of real kids' issues. From the Daily Mirror television pages, chaps, ITV, 8 p.m, Elky and Owl Gang. Song and dance show based on the day in the lives of some unemployed young people on their way to an Elky Brooks concert. They amuse themselves with various routines from ballet to breakdancing, and on their travels meet Gemma Craven and American singer Sam Harris. Whoa. Chaps, you know I've wasted so much of my valuable time trying to source a video of this, but sadly to no avail. But would you care to guess where it was set?
Nottingham.
Well, I automatically assume Liverpool because everything on the telly about unemployment was set there in the 80s. Yeah, but yes, yeah. Simon, I was fucking appalled to discover that the gig was filmed at Central's Lenton Lane Studios in Nottingham, the home of Bullseye and The Price is Right. Fucking hell, man. Amazing. The cradle of pop delivers once again. Who thought that the unemployed youths of the 80s craved Elkie Brooks?
Yeah, this is the reality of it. Yeah. Everyone thinks they must have been sort of, you know, going to see the Style Council or something, you know, a band who would show solidarity with their plight. But no, it was Elkie Brooks.
No, they want Pearl's a singer.
Yeah, and all her looks. Yeah.
So your hosts this evening are Gary Davis, who's still holding down the early afternoon slot between Simon Bates and Steve Wright, and is still recovering from Radio 1's 18th birthday party 3 days ago. Chaps, would you care to guess where such a prestigious event was held?
What, the 18th birthday party? Oh, I don't know. Kettering.
It was actually a garage in Cumbria.
Oh, right.
Article in the Daily Mirror 2 days ago, girls radio wonderful party in a garage. Teenage Rachel Miller threw an 18th birthday party yesterday and Radio 1 turned up. Rachel was born on September the 30th, 1967, the day Radio 1 was launched. So when she invited the station to her coming-of-age party, the BBC sent disc jockey Gary Davis to broadcast his midday show live from her garage. Late-night DJ John Peel also joined the party. Rachel from Coldbreck, Cumbria said, "When I sent the invitation, I never thought they would accept it. It was really wonderful. I don't know how I'm going to cap it on my 21st birthday." 50 guests dance in Rachel's garage as DJ Gary broadcast the show. He said, "It was a knockout, just like a real party." John Peel was even more delighted, for Coldbeck was the home of the legendary huntsman John Peel. "I was shocked to see the local pub named after me," he said. Fucking hell, BBC, chucking the money about just on a whim.
Yeah, and if I was born 5 days later, that could have been me.
Gary Davis, I mean, he looks absolutely basic. He looks like he's sort of fallen asleep in the tanning lounge.
This is his first Top of the Pops since his extended holiday, and by the look of that tan, it seems like he spent a fortnight on the planet Mercury.
Absolutely.
He looks like he's been carved from a block of Oxo. he's over ridgelid, I think the term of the time was.
Yeah, over ridgelid. I mean, I'll tell you what it reminds me of. You know, back in, you used to get this quite a few times in the 70s and 80s, you'd occasionally get these white tabloid journalists or even TV reporters going undercover to find out what it was really like to be a black person in Britain today. And they'd adopt this ludicrously unconvincing blackface. You could even see a bit of the white sometimes, you know, between the shirt and their neck.
My God.
And, you know, of course, they wander around getting very funny looks. And, yeah, he kind of looks like that, really. Yeah.
Black like Gary.
Or they'd be putting a tea towel on their heads and trying to sort of trick Bruce Grobbelaar into accepting a bribe or something.
Yeah.
It's like when Beadle was an oil sheet.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Yes.
This is his 26th go at presenting Top of the Pops, and he's become a permanent fixture in a talent pool which currently features Peter Powell, Mike Smith, Steve Wright, Dixie Peach, Mike Reed, and Simon Bates. And there's a new addition to the pool this week. Born in London in 1959, Paul Jordan spent his university years dividing his time between reading law and working in hospital radio. And just before his final year of passing the bar at Gray's Inn, he decided to jack it in and make a go of becoming a DJ. After sending a demo tape off to various stations, he was contacted by Radio City, the independent station for Liverpool and surrounding area, who were looking for a new DJ after Janice Long had departed. And by 1982, he was holding down the graveyard shift on City for 3 months, eventually moving to the late night slot and finally bedding down in the 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. slot by 1984. Advert in the Liverpool Echo, February 1984. Wind down to the best sounds around. Paul Jordan, 6 to 9. Essential listening for people who are really into today's music scene. Starting with the charts, Paul goes on to explore fringe music, especially from local bands, pop news, top 10 videos, and all the latest film reviews, plus scoop interviews with pop stars. Miss it if you dare. Fucking hell, interviewing local Liverpool bands in 1984, he must have sniffed around Frankie's crotch a few times. By 1985, he started to make a play for the top of the mountain and started sending demo tapes to Radio 1. And at the third attempt, he was signed up, beginning his career at the station on July the 1st of this year, filling in for Gary Davis while he was doing the Radio 1 roadshow. The following week, he filled in for Adrian John at the 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. slot and spent the rest of the summer bouncing around the weekday schedule as a de facto holiday cover, including 2 weeks in Janice Long's chair, before bedding down last Sunday in the 2:30 slot, taking over from Steve Wright, and will be beginning a regular 3 p.m. stint on Fridays tomorrow. So, chaps, it appears to be only a matter of time before he becomes a big part of Radio 1, and this is his debut appearance on Top of the Pops.
Yeah, but it's so weird, isn't it? I've never heard of the geezer.
No.
He doesn't even have a wiki page.
That's ridiculous.
I mean, talk about Radiohead's How to Disappear Completely. I mean, talk about being unpersoned, you know, airbrushed out of history. I mean, just wonder who knows did he put out a joint? You know, what did he eventually do that was, you know, so sordid, so unforgivable that even 1980s Top of the Pops presenters couldn't abide to have him in their ranks?
I thought that when I was doing research on previous chart music, his name turned up, I just thought, ooh, what did he do?
Yeah. So I can just imagine, actually, if you go, you know, if we went down to actually investigate all this, you know, if I'd actually gone down to BBC Television Centre and asked about, you know, Paul Jordan and being gaslit by the senior receptionist. Paul Jordan? There is no Paul Jordan, and there has never been a Paul Jordan. But, you know, why don't you look in your database? You just have to get... There is no point in my looking on the database, because there is no Paul Jordan, and there never has been a Paul Jordan at the British Broadcasting Corporation. Do I make myself clear? But I would advise you to leave the building, Mr. Stubbs, with immediate effect. No, it's just... it's just extraordinary, really. I mean, it's, you know, the mystery. It's a mystery, as somebody said.
Yeah, I mean, I'd absolutely never heard of him either. And, you know, this was an era where I had very little else to do other than sort of, you know, watch Top the Pops and listen to Radio 1. So it's bizarre how he's faded from not just my consciousness, but it seems everybody's, you know.
Yeah.
I know he only did Top of the Pops 6 times, but 6 is enough to leave some kind of impression, you know. Both the presenters here, there's an interesting dynamic. They both look well, sort of Miami Vice with their looks.
Oh, yeah.
And Paul Jordan's winning the battle of the sleeve push.
Most definitely.
But he does have this energy of a sort of competition winner, of somebody who's just kind of lucked their way into being there. Because the thing with Gary Davis at this point, he's a safe pair of hands by now. He's slick and confident, crucially, and professional. The thing with Paul Jordan is, when you see people in any walk of life who are nervous, it makes you nervous.
Yes.
And I got that instantly from him. He's trying too hard. He's got... And it's interesting that you say he sort of was a guy who would stand in when Janice Long or whoever went on their holidays, because he does have this kind of supply teacher energy about him.
Yes,
but it's
definitely,
like,
yeah.
It's a sort of trendy supply teacher. So, like, every time he goes, woo, or way, or whatever, it sounds really forced, you know? And he does this thing, you know, apart from the sleeve push, which I guess everyone did because it was fashionable at the time, he puts his hand in his pockets. It's as if he sort of, you know... thought, what are the signifiers of being the cool kid that I can do?
Yeah.
It's like, I always used to crack up at everyone saying Eric Cantona was so cool, right?
Mm.
Because to me, what he'd done, Cantona, was he popped the collar of his football shirt like he thought he was the Fonz, you know? And everyone thought, oh, he's so cool. But I just thought that's such a kind of French person's idea of what being cool means, is like turning up your collar. And yeah, Paul Jordan's a bit like that. Yeah, he's sort of like, you know, his sleeves are rolled up, he's got his hands in his pocket, he's sort of slouching in a kind of slightly kind of insolent, cool way. And all the way through, it's just trying really hard to be down with the kids. And he's only 26, but something about that trying too hard makes him seem older than he actually is, like an old person trying to be cool. You know what I mean?
And 26 in 1985 was probably about 32 in a sense, really.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
But yeah, Jordan, as a DJ, he's definitely in that young guy who's really into his music vein that's currently in vogue at Radio 1. And, you know, him and Dixie Peach, the other new recruit of the era, they've already nudged out Richard Skinner from the lineup, and it's Mike Reed's turn to fuck off next. But as far as Jordan goes, even though he's been on the same career path, he's clearly no Janice Long.
Well, it's interesting you say, like, young guy who's really into his music. I mean, did you get that from him? Because I think we've both listened to the same audio interview that is out there with
him. That's the look. That's the image that Radio 1 want to portray of people like him and Davis. But yeah, you're right, Simon. There's an interview of him floating about.
And he seems like a perfectly nice bloke, you know.
But he's a careerist DJ, isn't he?
Well, this is it. To me, he shares that fatal flaw that so many of the Radio 1 lot had, which is that he loves radio more than he loves music, and he loves the idea of being a presenter more than he loves music.
Yes.
I'm sure he was into his music as well, but for him, it does seem to be all about the airwaves and all that kind of stuff rather than the sounds that he's playing.
I think it's almost a prerequisite that you're not really into the music that much, you know, otherwise that shunts you towards the kind of the evening slot or even the graveyard slot. You know?
In some ways, I don't mind him not being this kind of strutting alpha male, you know, because we've had plenty of those on Top of the Pops, and they are monstrous, you know. And I'm sure I would rather spend a couple of hours in the pub with Paul Jordan than with Dave Lee Travis. Do you know what I mean?
Would you sooner see Paul Jordan play Macbeth, though?
But sadly, the way that these kind of alpha male bullies like Travis hold down their job is by their completely unearned confidence that they have.
Yeah.
And someone like Jordan, who just doesn't seem to have it, was probably never going to hold down that position in quite the same way.
The Pops, and welcome to Top of the Box for the very first time to Paul Jordan.
Thanks very much indeed, Gary. Have we got a great show for you tonight? We've got a wonderful show. We have Cameo, we have Iron Maiden, we also have Rene and Angela, and a brand new number one.
But first, to get us underway, a superb song at number 10 in the charts. Here is Colonel Abrams and Trent.
The syndromes pound, the TV screen flies through the ionosphere, and the pink vinyl explodes to reveal Davis in an appalling light grey suit with sleeves are rolled and American football-like shoulder pads, welcomes us to our Thursday evening pop treat, and then introduces his YTS lad Jordan, who's wearing a huge flimsy black and grey jacket over a white T-shirt with the sleeves rolled up even more. Jordan runs down some of the bill of fare on tonight in a manner more suited to blokes in flat caps and gilets selling sets of crockware in the market, and then pumps his fist and goes, "Way!" as Davis announces, "Trapped by Colonel Abrams." Born in Detroit in 1949, Colonel Abrams, yes, that's his real name, was relocated to New York in his teens, where he learned guitar and piano and won an amateur night at the Harlem Apollo. After a spell in the funk band Heavy Impact in the mid-70s, he started his own group, Conservative Manor, in 1976, before relocating to Minneapolis and becoming the lead singer of the funk band 94 Street until they split up in 1979 due to their guitarist getting a solo deal. He moved back to New York, got involved in the post-disco scene, and linked up with the WBLS DJ Timothy Anthony Regisford. And in 1984, they recorded an 8-track demo, which included the song Release the Tension, which absolutely blew up across the clubs of the five boroughs and beyond, even though it wasn't available in any shops and a cover was released by someone else. Unperturbed, he landed a deal with Streetwise Records and recorded another set of demos, including Music is the Answer. But it was this track which got his contract bought out by MCA, who, after throwing loads of different producers at him, including Cerrone, finally linked him up with Richard Burgess. Yes, Mr. Einstein a go-go himself.
Yeah.
After ripping through the clubs of America and getting to number one in the Billboard Dance Club Songs chart, it was put out over here, entering the charts at number 95 in early August, and took 5 weeks to get to number 34. The following week, after it jumped 6 places to number 28, some City Farm wankers did the Thatcherite stride to it at the end of that week's Top of the Pops, which helped it jump another 6 places to number 16. This week, after yet another 6-place jump, it's at number 10, and here he is, fresh off the plane, making his official Top of the Pops debut. And it's got to be said, looking like he's got a telegram to deliver to someone, as he's sporting that non-more 1985 garment, the Bolero jacket, beloved of Christopher Dean and Les Dennis, that's festooned with gold braid around the shoulders and sleeves, and adorned with golden buttons. It's quite the look, isn't it?
Yeah. I think, you know, it's meant to be a sort of visual pun on his military name.
Yes, indeed, yeah. There's lots of scrambled egg.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, he's got the epaulettes, the brocade, brass buttons. I thought it was a play on the colonel thing. But to me, he looks more like a bellboy in an upscale Hollywood hotel. I actually think he looks kind of amazing. He's got these pleated trousers and this Cab Calloway moustache. And he's never not doing something. If he's not singing, he's sort of windmilling his wrists around in a sort of come and get it, you cunts kind of way, you know. Or he's sort of bunny hopping up and down the spot during an instrumental break or whatever. Everything's very literal, I think, you know, the jacket and how, you know, he's on a small podium. He literally is trapped. He's surrounded by the City Farm wankers, you know, and, you know, just general audience members who are going mental, by the way. They're loving this.
Oh, yes. They fucking love it, don't they?
In their very British, hand-clappy, very much not Soul Train sort of way, you know what I mean? And, yeah, there's lots of weird camera angles shot from his waist height, up chin or up nose, as it were. Like a sort of blowjob POV, but from the POV of the giver, not the receiver. Of course, you know, yeah, this is his big moment. But I remember when he was just Lieutenant Abrams, you know, and I watched him push up the ranks, Captain Abrams, Major Abrams, and here he is, Colonel at last. We thought he could push on and become a brigadier, maybe even a major general, but it wasn't to be. And listen, right, if you think that's a shit joke, just be grateful that I abandoned a whole riff based on Colonel with a C being a homonym of Colonel with a K, meaning seed. There was nothing there. But it is confusing, though, right, because there wasn't just one other Colonel Abrams. There were two, right? During the first Gulf War in 1991, the US Army had two Colonel Abrams. Colonel John N. Abrams and Colonel Robert B. Abrams, both of whom went on to greater things. But in the first Gulf War, it's well documented what happened to American soldiers who were made prisoners of war under the supervision of Odai Hussein, Saddam's son. They were subjected to starvation, mock executions, mock castrations and chemical injections, as well as brutal beatings.
God, how can you mock a castration?
I know, that's...
I know, and they were made to appear on TV, famously, you know, battered and bruised, denouncing American war policy while blinking out the word torture in Morse code.
Yeah.
However, the Allies themselves took 69,000 Iraqi prisoners of war, and it's less well documented what happened to them.
Fancy that.
Yeah, although Human Rights Watch expressed concern that the US Army was reneging on its obligations under the Geneva Convention in terms of their treatment. And let's not kid ourselves, we know what happens when the Americans take prisoners of war, especially in Iraq. But I like to think that at least some of them, somewhere, around Albasaya, perhaps, in the Almathana province, just over the border from Kuwait, were under the watchful eye of either Colonel John N. Abrams or Colonel Robert B. Abrams, and they were able to heckle their captors. Hey, Colonel Abrams, I'm trapped. I'm like a man in a cage. I would love to think that happened.
There's a lot of confusion around this song, as we'll dip into later on, and the singer, particularly his name. So let's go back to that interview with Simon Witter in this week's NME, where he says, before I made it in music, I used to work in a personnel office, and people would come in and say, I spoke to you on the phone, but when I heard Colonel Abrams, I thought you'd be an old man in glasses. They expected me to look like the guy from Kentucky Fried Chicken. In fact, I was asked to attend the opening of a KFC joint in New Jersey, but I didn't want to. And one photographer wanted me to pose with a rifle. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. What he should have done, he should have mashed up Colonel Sanders and Father Abraham of the Smurfs and turned up looking like that.
Yeah.
Which is just basically Father Abraham with some glasses and and one of them stringy tie things.
A far-right chicken pimp, yeah.
Yes.
The same thing struck me, you know, as it did Simon, you know, Grapevines and all that. Same thing with Colonel Abrams as it did Colonel Gaddafi. If you're going to make yourself out for the big man, the top man, you know, why don't you just go for the top rank? I mean, if you're Colonel Gaddafi, you're outranked by your generals. There's going to be a bit of a shit dictator. I mean, it's like, so Colonel Abrams is outranked by the Funkadelic associate General Kane, you know. So if General Kane gets on top of the
box, or General Johnson.
Yeah, you're going to have to salute him, you know. It's a bit weird. Just, you know, just like you say, just call him Field Marshal Abrams.
Major Lance,
yes.
But then again, but that logic, like King, as in Love and Pride, outranks Prince, you know. So it's...
Yeah.
It would quite work, yeah. I mean, as regards the song, I mean, I was eating this sort of transatlantic electric funk for breakfast.
Oh, I think this is a fucking tune, mate.
Yeah.
1985 is mint.
I'm afraid I'm slightly less enthusiastic about it myself, personally.
No.
Sorry. Well, you know, I get that way, and then you can sing its praises and...
I guess I think it's not good enough for you.
Yeah, well, you know,
I could tell by the way you act and your attitude, David.
No, but when I wasn't dipping into a bit of Stockhausen or Sun Ra, it was this sort of affair. But, you know, so I was all set when I was first listening to this. Now, I'd have sat there and waited patiently for something to happen, you know, a sort of explosion, a little release, a sort of an ejaculation. But for me, it's just a bit stiff. You know, it just sort of robo-twitches inside this sort of self-imposed straitjacket. I mean, obviously, you know, it's called Trapped. I guess, you know, that's the idea. And I mean, I know Prince is doing this sort of minimalistic thing at this time, but things happen with Prince. And for me, it just doesn't hear. It's like a sort of moonwalk minus... the walk and the moon, you know.
I'm kind of stunned here. I thought David was going to love this record. I really did.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, no, I did as well. When I first started, I thought, this is for me. And it just, something just doesn't quite click on it for me, you know.
What it is for me, right, I think people talk a load of revisionist, self-aggrandizing bullshit about house music, okay? Nowadays, you get British people who pretend they were completely across what Larry Levan was doing at Paradise Garage, what Frankie Knuckles was doing in the warehouse, what the Belleville 3 were doing. Everybody is basically the person James Murphy from LCD Sound System is addressing in Losing My Edge. Everybody claiming they owned Don't Make Me Wait by the Peach Boys in 1982 on an import, right? Everyone claiming they had their fingers...
Did you, David?
Yes, I did.
Ah, for fuck's sake. Well, I suppose... Yeah, all right.
A fiver I spent on that. I mean, that was a fiver, a proper fiver back in 1982.
Well, everyone likes to be, you know, make out nowadays that they had their fingers on the pulse of New York and Chicago and Detroit. Bollocks. All right, David did, but most people didn't, right? If they're honest, the first house music most people heard in the UK was Love Can't Turn Around by Farley Jackmaster Funk featuring Daryl Pandy, which was number 10 in September 86. And the thing that softened us up to make us receptive to that wasn't Derek May or whoever. It was this kind of thing. It was Love Can't Turn Around was a hit because of things like this coming first.
True.
It's proto-house, really.
Yeah, true. And I think,
have you heard Release the Tension, Simon?
No.
Oh, it's housey as fuck.
This is Colonel Abrams, another track, right?
Yeah, recorded in 1984, and you just listen to it and go, ooh, fucking hell.
Right.
Here's the foundations of the house, if you will.
And stuff like this, stuff like Trapped, is what I was dancing to at the aforementioned Feathers Disco at Barry Island, and the other one, Tramps, at the land end of the causeway. And I mentioned that I had this little gang of mates in the sixth form at Barry Boys, and we all went to house parties together. That's house with a small H. But we also went to Feathers and Tramps together, and there was me, there there was my mate Neil, who's a listener to the pod. Hello, Neil.
Hey, up, Neil.
There was Richie, and there was Symes. The problem was I was also called Symes, so we needed some form of disambiguation.
And Simon Bates.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you really let yourself be called Symes?
Yeah, yeah. Symes. Yeah, I mean, it was partly inspired by Simon Bates, I suppose. It's a bit of a piss take of that. But,
okay, so, fair enough. All right.
You know, I called him Symes. He tried to call me Symesy or Symesy Baby, right? But it never stuck, perhaps thankfully. There was a half-hearted effort on my part to call him Big Symes and me Little Symes, but that was never going to fly because I'm not little. I'm 6 foot, you know.
Yeah.
He's 6 foot six, so it should have been Big Symes and 1 inch above average height Symes over here. But anyway, the thing is, there's this gang of us. We all had very different tastes in music in terms of what we were listening to at home. There was a ghetto blaster in the sixth form common room, and, you know, everybody's sort of trying to fight over what tapes got played on it. And I was into the Smiths and the Cure, and Neil was into Skritti Politti and Howard Jones. Richie was into U2, I think, and Symes was into Springsteen. The one common denominator was that we all loved Prince. But when we all went out to Tramps or Feathers, all that went out the window. All your kind of tribal things, all the stuff you cared about, and, you know, that was your musical DNA, it kind of just flew out the window, and we were just happy dancing to stuff like Trapped. So there was this, and there was We Don't Have To by Jermaine Stewart. There was Let the Music Play by Shannon.
That is a tune.
Ain't Nothing Going On But the Rent by Gwen Guthrie.
Also tune.
And sometimes I'd pester Sammy Black, who was the local DJ, to play something by the Cult, selfishly. But that would clear the dance floor, you know. That would clear the dance floor.
Yeah.
This is the stuff everyone fucking loved. And when Morrissey comes along and goes, burn down the disco, hang the blessed DJ, because the music they constantly play, it says nothing to me about my life. Even as a Smiths fan, I thought, fuck off. The music they constantly play doesn't have to say something to me about my life. It cheers me up, right?
No.
It's possible to be a miserable teenage indie fan 6 days a week, but put your shiny dancing shoes on and go out on a Friday and have some fun. So I absolutely love this record, and so did all of my friends.
Mm. You've touched upon something there, Simon, because we need to remember that in 1985, this sort of thing would have been lads' music. You know what I mean? All the rough-ass youths I knew at school wouldn't be listening to indie guitar rubbish or whatever the equivalent of Oasis was in 1985. They'd be getting their chinos on, piling into Shivago's or Barry Noble's Astoria and shaking their arses to this. I mean, it wouldn't be until, I don't know, the Happy Mondays came along that the lads started drifting towards that end of the spectrum. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting because this sort of music was also considered music for girls, or perhaps that was a little bit later on, when sort of handbag house came, like that pejorative term, handbag house, that all the girls be dancing on their handbags. But I guess, above all, it was music for normals. It was music for, you know, just your ordinary
townies.
Kids, townies, yeah. And the thing is, it was superior music for normals. This was an era when the stuff that your normals went to Feathers and Tramps were dancing to was fucking brilliant. And this record, it just fucking kicks ass. The producer, you mentioned it was, you know, Richard Burgess, Einstein or Go-Go. You wouldn't necessarily expect him to come out with something with this much funk to it, although he did produce Spandau Ballet, Chart Number One, Paint Me Down, so he got the funk as well. It might not be the most obvious person to produce a track like this,
but I
think it's an amazing record. Very strange lyrics though, eh?
God, yeah.
He says that he doesn't want her folks to turn him over to the hands of the law. What's he done? Yeah. What have you done, Colonel Abrams? What have you done?
He's 36 here, so why is he bothered about what her mum and dad think?
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck him.
I mean, if he wants legal representation, fortunately, Paul Jordan is right there. But yeah, there's definitely some kind of backstory to this song. What it's like it's part of a bigger piece. Like, you imagine it's part of some kind of opera or some kind of concept album. Like, you know, Keith West's excerpt from a teenage opera or something like that. That, you know, if you hear the whole thing, you know why he's running from the hands of the law. And there's all that thing, you know, if you think I can afford to support you, if you want to ever think about ever settling down.
Yeah, he's the one who wants to get trapped. Because you think the song's Trapped, it's like, oh, I've got my girlfriend pregnant, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
I've got to get married. But no, he's the one who wants to settle down.
Yeah.
Mm.
You alluded in your intro to the guitarist in his former band who went on to greater things.
Mm, yes.
This is a bit of a myth. Someone in the press department of MCA has played a fucking blinder here because we're talking about Prince, obviously. Perhaps not obviously, but Colonel Abrams' connection to Prince is minimal, apart from also having a first name that is a rank or title, but is actually his real name. What happened was there was a funk band in the mid-70s in Minneapolis called 94 East.
Yeah.
And they were led by a guy called Pepe Willie, who was married to Prince's cousin and was a sort of mentor figure to Prince and to Andre Simone and all the other Minneapolis funk musicians. And 94 East's lineup at various times included Prince, Andre Simone, Matt Fink, Dr. Fink, and Bobby Z, all later members of the Revolution, of course.
No.
The only recording that 94 East made with Colonel Abrams was a couple of tracks for a single called Fortune Teller in 1977, which was written by one of the Motown backing band, the Funk Brothers, Hank Cosby.
Ooh.
And by the time that was recorded, Prince had already left and was working on his first album, For You. But according to Matt Thorne's Prince biography, what happened was that Prince just ran into Pepe Willie and said, oh, you know, yeah, I'll play a bit of guitar on this track for you. Also, according to Pepe Willie himself, in the other Prince book by Dave Hill, A Pop Life, the two never actually met.
Right.
So Prince played his guitar in the studio separately to Colonel Abrams recording his vocals. And by the way, I've got about a dozen books on Prince, and I looked through all of them to research this. Only two of them even mention Colonel Abrams in the index.
Right.
The single never actually got released because the deal they had with Polydor fell through. So for that very tenuous Prince connection to get mentioned, as it does in this episode of Top the Pops, in fact, just makes you think that, yeah, someone at MCA is working overtime and deserves a pay rise.
Funny you should say that, Simon, because in next week's Daily Mirror White Hot Club, there's this headline, Colonel's Rocket.
Oh.
Hit singer Colonel Abrams has launched a blistering attack on his old pal Prince. He has a dreadful voice and no sense of style, says the good Colonel, whose song Trapped is at number 4. He once played in the same band as Prince and claims, man, he couldn't sing. I had to do it all.
Oh.
Fucking hell, that's some severe over-egg.
Yeah, I mean, come on, this shows that I was right, isn't it? Come on, he's bogus.
Him saying that he was in the same band as Prince is a bit like anybody in the current Blackpool FC squad saying they were in the same football team as Stanley Matthews.
Yeah, you know? Matthews, and then saying he was shit. And I had to do everything.
Yeah. I had to do all the dribbling for him. Yeah.
Top of the Pops' relatively new neon set, working to full effect here, you have to say.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
essentially recreating what Colonel Abrams must be doing all over the country right now. It's a PA at a sparsely attended but comfortable nightclub. You know, he's standing on a black circular platform surrounded by the kids on the floor and members of City Farm on slightly shorter plimps. And the only disappointment I had from this performance is that there's some nubby white stripes around the Colonel's plinth that makes it look like he's on a trampoline. And when he starts doing that weird little skipping dance, you think, oh, fucking hell, he's going to start doing some proper somersaults any minute now. But alas, no.
Mm. Well, there you are, you see. There aren't the somersaults.
I mean, you're not easily pleased, David. You expect somersaults from your proto-house singers.
Yeah.
Metaphorical somersaults. Jeez,
you know, he's giving it loads.
He's even grabbing his wrist, David. Yeah. What more do you want to indicate how trapped he is?
Yeah. True.
The thing is, yeah, it is quite housey sounding from this distance because it's got that sort of synth, the top line of the synth, that's quite housey.
Mm.
It's quite busy, though. Rhythmically, it's quite busy, and that's what makes it not house, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's only when things get stripped down and boiled to the very basics, you know, or basics, that you actually get to what house music is. But all the elements are here, really.
Yeah, Richard Burgess has added a bit of high energy-ness, hasn't he, with the stabby synths.
Yeah, it is quite stabby. Yeah. It doesn't have the house cadence, but it. But I sense. I think what Simon says has a point actually about the sort of the straightness of it, the linearness of it. You know, perhaps preparing people for House. Yeah,
that NME interview we alluded to earlier. They're clearly painting him as the next in the line of soul men. When, yeah, you're right. He is a House pioneer, and I'd go as far to say is that we as a public are being House trained in this performance. Don't you think?
Yes.
The other thing that was in that NME interview that you read earlier was that people kept comparing him to Luther Vandross and Teddy Pendergrass and people like that. I actually listened to a radio interview with Colonel Abrams from 1987, where he acknowledged both those influences, but he said he was more influenced by female singers like Nancy Wilson, The Supremes and Dionne Warwick. But he also said that he thought singers like him had a duty to be a male role model, which meant he comes out with quite a lot of unreconstructed stuff. Like, you can look good without looking feminine, and you can be the head of the household, always kind of like, you know, strong black man kind of rhetoric, which is kind of interesting. I found in another interview, for a TV interview this time, from 92, by which time he's claiming to have been one of the inventors of house music. You know, inventor, you know, that's a bit of a stretch. You know, even I'll say that. And he now considered himself, by 92, to be part of acid jazz, interestingly.
Right.
And he was saying he's added a new aggression to his music, which he thought was going to, you know, finally make him break through and be a star in the US. Listener, it didn't.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that in the UK, we went fucking crazy for this stuff.
Yes,
you know,
we did.
This was number three, you know, number three in the proper charts, half a million copies sold. But in America, you know, stuff like this, just he couldn't get arrested. Well, ironically, you know.
Or even court-martialed.
Yes.
Yeah. I've often wondered why it is that great black American pop struggles or has struggled historically to chart in the proper Billboard charts. And I don't know if it's just to do with how the charts were compiled over there, because surely, you know, the African-American population must have been buying stuff like this in fairly significant numbers. Is it just not getting registered by Billboard, or is it, you know, sort of segregated off and sort of lumped into their R&B chart or their dance chart or whatever? Or is it that records like this were selling through shops, which by their very nature were segregated, whereas in this country, you know, maybe in cities like London, Birmingham, Manchester, there might have been kind of black music specialist shops, but mostly people were just buying this stuff from your local HMV or your local Woolworths once it's charted. I don't know. You got any theories on that?
Yeah, we're skill and Americans are twats. Yeah, I need to work on that a bit more. But, you know, that's the basic crux of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting, though. We can sort of slap ourselves on the back a bit sometimes when we look at the chart positions of these what to us seem like classic tracks, and you see that they absolutely fucking bombed. But it even goes back to the 70s, things like, I don't know, Odyssey, or well, that's more the early 80s, but Limmy and Family Cooking that we talked about before.
Yeah.
Stuff that just did nothing in this state.
And I suppose radio stations have got something to do with it. You know, we didn't have black radio stations in the 70s and 80s.
No, radio wasn't segregated. So if something like this was getting played, it was getting played to everyone. It wasn't sort of being racially profiled and, you know, and sort of ghettoized, as it were, in radio terms and marketing terms and everything else.
So the following week, Trapped made its fourth sixth-place jump on the bounce, getting to number four. And the week after that, it began a three-week stand at number three, spending 7 weeks in the top 10. His next dent upon the charts came at the end of the year when Streetwise Records released Music Is the Answer Over Here, but it only got to number 84 in November. But the official follow-up, The Truth, only made it to number 53 the following month. He'd get back into the top 40 when I'm Not Going to Let You made it to number 24 in March of 1986, but his last MCA release in the UK, the painfully apt How Soon We Forget, only got to number 74 for 2 weeks in August of 1987, and he never troubled the charts again. And sadly, he dropped off the radar until a GoFundMe crowdfund was started for him in 2015 as he was homeless and suffering from diabetes, and he died a year later at the age of 67.
Wow, that's sad.
He's 6 foot
Reacher's tour comes from New York. Used to be in a band with Prince. Super, Colonel Abrams and Trev. Right now, here's the highest new entry in the chart this week. Straight in at number 20 for Iron Maiden.
Davis, on his own in front of some poncy 80s ironmonger, tells us about the Colonel Abrams Prince lie before pitching us straight into Running Free by Iron Maiden. Formed in Leighton in 1975, Ash Mountain were a group put together by the bassist Steve Harris, who told him that his band name was shit and they wanted to be called Iron Maiden instead. After they played their first gig at St Nick's Hall in Poplar in May of 1976, they took up a residency at the Cart and Horses in Stratford and underwent myriad lineup changes, with band members being sacked for not having enough on-stage charisma, pretending to be in Kiss and coughing up fake blood during gigs, getting the arse about the band recruiting a keyboard player, being that keyboard player and it not suiting the band, and pretending to play guitar with their teeth, which led the band to split up at the end of the year. In early 1977, however, Harris and the guitarist Dave Murray decided to have another go, finally completing the lineup when their new drummer Doug Sampson recommended Paul Andrews, a hotel chef who changed his name to Paul Di'Anno to play up his Italian heritage, as lead singer. After recording a four-song demo, they passed it on to Neil Kay, who ran a disco in the back room of a pub in North London called the Bandwagon Heavy Metal Soundhouse, who was so taken by it that he listed one of the tracks from it, Prowler, at number one in his Soundhouse chart, which was published every week by Sounds. After the tape crossed the desk of Rod Smallwood, a student gig promoter who managed Steve Holly and Cockney Rebel for a while, he expressed an interest in managing them and set up two pub gigs, although the first one fell through when the band didn't fancy playing so early in the evening, and they had to play the second one without Di'Anno because he'd been arrested outside for showing off with his knife in front of a copper. Undeterred, Smallwood encouraged them to set up their own label and put out their demo, with the run of 5,000 copies selling out immediately, which led to record company interest and eventual deal with EMI, who immediately put two of their tracks on the compilation LP Metal for Mothers and catapulted them to the forefront of the new wave of British heavy metal. At the same time, their debut single, This Tune, was put out and it entered the charts at number 46, leading to the band being immediately rushed into the Top of the Pop studio, sandwiched between Carrie by Cliff Richard and Coward of the County by Kenny Rogers, which helped it get up to number 34. By mid-1981, after the band had notched up three more top 40 hits and were midway through a world tour, Di'Anno had become a proper custard gannet, and the rest of the band decided to knob him off and replace him with the former frontman of Samson, Bruce Dickinson, which propelled Maiden to a run of six top 20 hit singles in a row and three top three LPs, including Number of the Beast, which spent 2 weeks atop the LP charts in April of 1982. This single, a cover of their debut and the follow-up to Aces High, which got to number 20 in November of 1984, is the lead-off cut from their next LP, Live After Death, which comes out next week and was recorded in Long Beach, California and Hammersmith Odeon during the World Slavery Tour, which started in Warsaw in August of 1984 and ended in California in July of 85. The band preferred the Hammersmith version, but according to Bruce Dickinson, the lighting engineer had a cob on with a film crew and deliberately made the lights too dim to render any shooting usable, so they had a go with what we're seeing here, because video rules the music industry these days. It's thudded into the chart this week at number 20, this week's highest new entry, and here they are, getting some American lads worked up. Mm. So, chaps, the World Slavery Tour, 331 days, 189 gigs, 25 countries, 4 continents. Apparently, there were going to be some dates in South Africa, but they were cancelled by the South Africans who objected to the word slavery. Loads of cash raked in. One very knackered band who have taken the rest of the year off, hence them putting this out as a stopgap and a prelude to the live album.
Mm. Apparently, after Bruce Dickinson's first big European tour with Iron Maiden, he suffered a real bout of depression because all of his dreams had been fulfilled. It was I was reading Andrew O'Neill's book, The History of Heavy Metal, and he compares it to Alexander the Great weeping because there were no worlds left to conquer.
Yeah, yeah. Like Paul Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
My mate Andrew, the metaller that I've talked about before, that's Andrew who lived next door, not Andrew who was a member of the Mary Brennell Boys Murder with me. He had that album, Metal for Mothers, but the thing is, we didn't know what that meant, so we thought it was Metal for Muthas. And I said to him, who's Muthas then? And he said, I don't know, just somebody called Muthas.
Sounds like a Doctor Who villain.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm. Oh, God, Iron fucking Maiden. I've got to say, we've had some metal bands on Chart Music before. I've really enjoyed, you know, watching Twisted Sister and Motorhead and things like that. This has put me in a really bad mood about heavy metal. Yeah, it's just sort of made me revert to my sort of not that deeply buried view that heavy metal is just fucking stupid, you know. It's just sort of thwarted masculinity. It's power fantasies for inadequate teenage boys, you know. It's all about male heroism, and people will sort of scream in disagreement about this, but for me, heavy metal is very right wing. I mean, there's literally, you know, quite a lot of far right stuff going on in the world of metal, but I just mean there's something inherently right wing about this music that is based around fantasies of power. In this song, okay, Dickinson didn't write it, it's a Paul Di'Anno song, but yeah, you know, it's about, you know, this 16-year-old who's you know, is running free, and it's so, oh God, this American bullshit, man. The American bullshit in the lyrics. Just 16, a pickup truck. You know, fucking pickup trucks in Eastland.
No,
you know.
Apparently, Paul Di'Anno wrote this about when he was a skinhead.
Right.
This is a skinhead song. It's Hersham Boys.
Yeah.
With more hair.
A skinhead who somehow got a pickup truck and is hitting the gas and ends up in an LA jail, for fuck's sake.
Maybe a Leighton jail.
Yeah. The thing with Maiden, to me, right, is that I don't know if you ever read those war comics as a child. You know, like, they were kind of A5 sized things, like,
oh, Commando.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, it's all sort of square jawed Germans who would go aye if you threw a grenade at them, that kind of thing.
Donnerwetter.
Yeah. Eat lead, Fritz.
Yeah, and Maiden aren't coming from rock and roll. They're coming from that's where Maiden are coming from. So many of their songs are about war or enslavement and things like that.
Well, the World Slavery Tour, every gig begins with "We shall fight them on the beaches," the Churchill speech.
Exactly. And, you know, they've got that beer that they sell, Trooper beer. I mean, it's got this picture of Eddie in sort of military uniform, Eddie their mascot, waving a tattered Union Jack and all of that.
Looking like he's in the Libertines.
But Maiden's attitude to the horrors of war is really ambiguous, I think. It's this kind of mix of disgust and glee, right? There is this sort of craving for gore and mayhem among prepubescent boys, isn't there? And grown men who've never quite stopped being prepubescent boys. And Maiden kind of have it both ways. That's their modus operandi here. Because, like, Run to the Hills, right? Run to the Hills, you can make a defence of it, saying it's this kind of excoriating critique of the genocide inflicted on the indigenous peoples of America. But the relish, the sheer relish with which Dickinson rasps the words, raping the women and wasting the men, right? That is just made for the adolescent fans of Iron Maiden to punch the air, you know, drooling like, yeah, rape, death, you know. So you have this kind of having it both ways thing. And I think in some ways I'm quite grateful to Iron Maiden, because we live in a time now where metal and alternative music have kind of merged.
Right? Yeah.
And a lot of people think that metal is goth, goth is metal, and it's all part of this continuum. But for me, Maiden served this kind of useful reminder that metal was all about reinforcing patriarchy and hierarchy, all that royalist imagery and all that flag waving and, you know, shall we say, traditional attitudes towards sexual equality. That stuff was never alternative, never cool. And metal existed for weaklings, you know. Kids at my school who were into metal, they were not the tough kids.
No.
They were sort of acne-encrusted, bespectacled, runty kids, really. And they'd wear their leather jacket like a protective carapace, you know.
Yes.
And metal allows them to live out these vicarious power fantasies, that kind of stinky Doddington rock, allows them to feel hard and to feel tough, you know. And I think that's what metal's all about. And all of that I just said is an opinion that I have, and I sometimes try and suppress that. And I, you know, I've got really good friends who are into metal, like, you know, John Doran from The Quietus gives talks about this, about how great metal is, and I think I'm going to be interviewing him at one of these talks later in the year, so this is going to be interesting. I respect their view, but I can't, things like Maiden make it so hard for me to get on board with it, you know. I'll shut up for a bit and let David talk.
Yeah, let the rock expert have his say.
Yeah, I mean, it's fucking rubbish, isn't it? I mean, you know, that's this word is absolute fucking garbage. I mean, you got, you know, these adolescent West Coast dreams, you know, they're wearing trousers that make Spinal Taps look positively semiotic. Desperate rubbish, absolute piss garbage. But, you know, I mean, I absolutely agree with everything that Simon says, you know, about the kind of, you know, the sense of trying to reimpose patriarchy, having a vicarious joy in war and rape and death, etc., etc. And it was felt like it was despised heavy metal. I suppose now the only way I look at it is that I see it as perhaps a sort of equivalent to the, you know, World Wrestling Federation or something like that, you know, or whatever it is, WWE.
Oh, careful, Al's going to come for you now.
There's part of me that kind of likes all of that. And I mean, I was always very much more, I became much more endeared towards heavy metal people. Although I never interviewed Iron Maiden. When I actually interviewed them, and it was like, bless you, you have something to say, you know, that you knew part of their job was entertainment. Yeah. And I suppose the most charitable thing I can think is that, like, all of these elements are there, but perhaps they're not necessarily insidious because everybody involved is aware that it's a fantasy, perhaps, at some level, and it's just a way of getting the rocks off, you know. Iron Maiden around this time, you know, they're well established by this point, but I just think that they feel that heavy metal will be taken more seriously. There's a double standard. There was an interview with Steve Harris around this time. It was in an American magazine, you know, and he says, like, hey, look, somebody will go along and see a David Bowie show, and he brings on a big scary monster on stage or something, and they go, it was wonderful, it was very entertaining, and everybody had a party. And they go to an Iron Maiden concert, we bring a big scary monster on, and suddenly we're worshipping the devil. We worship, it was scaring small children or whatever particular bogey you want to lay at the door of music. People love to lay at our door. I mean, first of all, laying a bogey at Steve Harris's door is a bit of a slightly thing, but, you know, I think this idea that there's a sort of a double standard and that David Bowie is revered more than Iron Maiden is perhaps to do with things like, you know, Ziggy Stardust and the Berlin trilogy, and I don't think Iron Maiden produced quite an equivalent of all of that.
Yeah.
Around this time, that, I mean, 84, 85, and I used to, like, have mates who were heavy metal fans, and fucking hell. We used to call myself sweaties, they were called.
Right.
And there was no sweaty quite like a Yorkshire sweaty, I tell you. I mean, piss-hurling, Cro-Magnon meatheads. Seriously, not even the missing link between man and ape, you know, but the missing link between ape and divot, you know. I mean, just fucking awful, horrible people, actually. In fact, actually thinking about them makes me kind of, yeah, I'm beginning to kind of get my gander a bit, like, pricey now, actually. Now that I'm thinking about these fucking what's weird is, but it doesn't, it seems to be, as Simon said, it's, there's now sort of metal goth alternative kind of sort of all merged into one, and you've got people like Sun, you know, who are kind of avant metal and are brilliant, you know. It's become kind of respectable, but I think that the sort of the crapness of an Iron Maiden, I don't know that there's an equivalent for that these days, certainly not on a kind of mass scale, you know. It's like metal seems to be one of those, in some respects, a kind of slightly in the Iron Maiden sense, a kind of extinct genre in some ways.
I don't know. I mean, people like Rob Zombie can fill the O2. I mean, don't underestimate it. It is still fucking massive as a live thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at this concert, it's clearly a massive gig that they're playing. But Maiden can play those kind of venues still now.
Yes.
They really can.
Oh, yeah. But I just wonder if it's like a kind of new generations and new, you know, kids coming through. I mean, you know, you never hear metal blasters out of an open-top car.
No.
Not around our end, anyway.
No, I don't know, man. I think it's still huge.
I mean, even by 1985, metal was passé.
Yeah.
I don't know, because metal is split into two directions by the mid-80s. On the one hand, you had glam metal, that whole LA thing of you know, Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses and stuff like that. But you also had thrash. Thrash was coming along at this time. You had the big four of thrash, who were Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax and Slayer.
Yeah. But I mean, the new wave of British heavy metal.
Oh, in Britain?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, the first... Yeah. Yeah, the first Nwobom lot had actually started cracking America, as as we see with Maiden. So basically, the two that really made it are Leopard and Maiden, aren't they? You know,
and Judas Priest.
Yeah, did they? Right, okay.
If you've not seen it, have a look at Heavy Metal Parking Lot.
All right.
Which I believe was filmed round about this time, before a Judas Priest concert. And it's just loads of youths drinking pissy beer and throwing up the devil horns and everything, saying all rock and roll woo, and then the bloke interviews them and he's, you know, he talks to one lad, says, oh, what are you up to now? He says, oh, well, I'm joining the army next weekend.
Right.
Yeah, woo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
rock and roll.
The thing is, with Maiden, is that there's no sex in their music. I mean, this song is actually a really rare example where they talk about girls, you know, and that's because it's a song from their very early days, written by Paul Janis, where it's like, pulled her at the bottle top, whiskey, dancing, disco hop. Now all the boys are after me, and that's the way it's going to be. Yeah. But yeah, it's quite rare for Maiden to sing about something like that, about girls, because normally they are on about war and death. And in that respect, they have more in common, because there was this, you know, dichotomy that I spoke of in this split in mid-80s metal. Even though they're not thrash, Maiden have got more in common with Slayer than with Guns N' Roses or something like that, because you know, Slayer famously sang these really dodgy, questionable lyrics about the Nazi death camps, where it's really not too clear that they disapprove, let's put it that way. And you know, as I said, with Maiden, they seem to really revel in the blood and gore of war. I think maybe it's the same kind of mentality, just very different musically, to bands like Slayer.
As we've discovered, chaps, with Thin Lizzy and Motorhead, metal bands are very keen to put out live singles or EPs. And, you know, it's a win-win, isn't it? The fans get a souvenir of being wedged up against other people in denim and leather while having their senses assailed. And, you know, the band gets to knock out an old song as a single. But I'm detecting an ulterior motive here, because to me, this is Bruce Dickinson painting out the image of Paul Di'Anno by covering the latter's own song and having a bigger hit with it.
Yeah, like when Taylor Swift re-recorded all her albums to obliterate the earlier Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
What's odd, though, once again, I interviewed Martin Fry recently, and he was talking about the very early days of ABC, you know, perhaps like Vice Versa Stroke ABC, and he was talking about the, you know, the Sheffield scene. And I thought, you know, I might get him onto, like, you know, Clock DVA and Carrie Voltaire and people like that. And he says, oh, no, it was all right, you know. Yeah, the drummer from Saxon, he was great. He was a really good bloke. You know, he really helped us out, you know, and he helped us out, gave us tips, you know, and all that kind of stuff, you know, gear and whatnot. And I was like, you fraternise with the foe, the enemy, the arch enemy. The idea, I've been absolutely horrified if I'd have known that Martin Fry was consorting with fucking Saxon.
Shoot that poison arrow through David's heart.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, Saxon, another example of a band we've talked about that I really enjoyed sort of reacquainting with them. There's just something about Maiden that rubs him the wrong way, and it's probably the whole Brexit thing. That's part of it as much as anything else, you know. Fucking all right, you know, he's obviously not a complete idiot. He can fly a plane, which is more than I can do, right? But I just don't think Dickinson's the brightest bulb in the box, because he voted for Brexit and then he started complaining that Brexit made it difficult for bands to tour. Like, what the fuck did you think was going to happen?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
As far as the video goes, it's your bog standard, you know, band on stage job. But they are singing live. They're not miming to anything. And as you'd expect in 1985, there is a lot of spandex on that stage.
There is.
And it kind of works in a metal band because, you know, it allows free and easy movement as Bruce Dickinson capers about and rests a foot on the monitors and the rest of the band just, I don't know, just stand about and lean forward when they're doing a solo. Yeah. But it's not practical for the metal fan, is it? Wearing spandex. Because where are you going to put your keys?
You need to have a very big belt buckle, which Dickinson does, in order
or a codpiece,
yes, in order to hide, you know, what's going on there, because they're quite indecent. You mentioned the guitar solo. I don't know if you noticed, and I think it might have been David who described Big Country's bagpipe style as being the most pointless guitar innovation ever. But Maiden do this thing where twin guitarists play exactly the same solo at exactly the same time.
Yeah,
it's just a really ridiculous stunt. It's like something out of ice skating more than rock and roll.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean?
Yeah.
I also noticed there's someone in a really shit homemade Eddie costume in the crowd. Did you see that?
Yes.
It looked like the head was made out of foam from an old sofa or something.
Amazingly, we don't see Eddie in the video.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Because by this time, he was a 30-foot sarcophagus, because they were going for a very Egyptian theme for this.
Well, you know, maybe Michael Grade wouldn't have it. You know, didn't want to scare people.
Yeah.
By the way,
yeah,
chaps, do you know how spandex got its name?
No.
Because it expands?
Well, nearly, Simon. It's an anagram of expand.
Oh, right, yeah, cool.
And I was going to say that spandex would be superseded in the early 90s by Lycra, but I did a bit of research. Actually, it turns out that Lycra is a brand name of a company that makes spandex, and the term was adopted across the industry to help the fabric move away from the image portrayed by bands such as Iron Maiden.
That's what I thought, because I got right into the Lycra game in the late 80s, let me tell you.
Did you know?
Yeah. When I arrived in London and started going on the goth scene, because the thing with PVC or leather trousers is they're never tight enough, you know.
Yeah.
If you wanted shiny but sort of drainpipe like legs, there was no point getting PVC or leather, because they were just all sort of flaccid and baggy and saggy. So what you needed was Lycra. So yeah. I would buy these Lycra leggings, and people would say to me, "Oh, nice spandex you got going on." Oh, what are you talking about? Never heard of spandex. But yeah, it turns out it's exactly the same fucking thing.
Yeah. Did it help reduce our sweat at clubs?
I mean, I couldn't possibly comment.
Is it better or worse than PVC?
I mean, it's better for the sweat point of view. You haven't got to put talcum powder down it or anything like that.
Better at wicking.
It tucks nicely into your sort of little pixie boots with skulls for buckles, put it that way.
And where did you put your keys?
That would be revealing too much.
Okay.
yeah. I'd always have like a leather jacket or something. That was the trouble with it. Yeah, you've got no way to put things.
Yeah.
I tell you what I've come up with now as the solution to that problem is a sporran.
Ooh.
I got this kind of fetish sporran. it's a black PVC sporran that I got from a kind of fetish wear retailers, and it's perfect for that kind of thing. If you're wearing a garment which doesn't allow stashing of your keys, a sporran is your friend. So. Yeah. There's a fashion tip for the pop craze youngsters.
Anything else to say?
Nah. Seriously, fuck Iron Maiden, man.
What? Who's that?
Fuck is Neil! That? What the fuck are you doing here?
Fuck's sake.
Hiding under the desk.
My metal dial was twitching, man. I heard Maiden chat, and I cannot let it pass without sticking my tuppenny in.
There's something wrong with you, man. I'm calling the police.
Every time the subject of Maiden has come up, Neil said he can't wait to get stuck into him. Who am I to deny a lad his opportunity? So come on, Neil.
He's rising up like the Coventry Maiden troll.
It needs saying, man. It needs saying. No, for me, to be honest with you, I massively agree with Simon and David on this. I have to say that Maiden, like, say, their American equivalent would be, I don't know, Wasp or something. They're that point. They're that marking point, as Simon was kind of saying, that I need in metal. They're a kind of mark-off point that says, you know, just stop. You've gone too far. You know, my daughter, as previously explained, is quite a retro metalhead, and she burns a lot of CDs for the car called Poisonous Metal. We're actually up to volume 12 now. And they've pushed things into my life, you know, that if you'd have told me back in the
80s... Metal for daughters. Spelled D-A-U-T-A. Yeah.
But they've pushed things into my life. You know, if you'd have told me back in the 80s that I'd be earnestly sort of singing along to these things in my car in my 50s, I'd have seen that as a colossal defeat in my life, really. You know, Quiet Riot, Accept, Scorpions, Michael Schenker Group, all of them, you know, Tigers of Pantang, Witchfind, you know, Walpurgis Night by Stormwitch. These are all things that I now sort of dig. But she peppers these compilations. I mean, she put on one Kiss track on one of them, and I'm not having that one. That one could just comes out the CD player as soon as it gets to that. But she does pepper these compilations with Maiden tracks, which only ever sort of kicks off arguments, all of which eventually end up with me, you know, just driving down the A45 with my thumb down like the audience for Spinal Tap's Jazz Odyssey, and me getting a dead arm, you know. But I mean, as I patiently explained to her, Maiden suck, and I use that Americanism carefully, because I think something Simon said, there's a real incipient
Americanization of so many aspects of metal's revival and rehabilitation in recent years. It's entirely along kind of American lines of fandom that I would suggest, yeah, include wrestling, also include the kind of consumption of hot sauces, you know. You can trace a lot of it back to Wayne's World and Bill and Ted, I think. But the reason I really don't like Maiden, and I cannot get along with Maiden despite an awful lot of dreadful metal shit being sort of rehabilitated in my mind, well, it's several reasons. I mean, Simon's mentioned the kind of the warfare aspect of Maiden, and you know, metal obviously uses a lot of warfare imagery from sort of War Pigs onwards, you know. And through bands like Thin Lizzy, who obviously Maiden are taking musical and lyrical ideas from. But Maiden's obsession with military stuff, it never becomes critical in a kind of War Pigs or Emerald style. It's firmly a sort of really celebratory boy's own Airfix view of history. Because it's for those kind of boys who would have, you know, collected a 24-part series by Orbis on Tanks of the Eastern Front or something. You know? It's that Sven Hassel IE thing, as Simon said. And you know, that obviously feeds into Diano and Dickinson's Brexitness and right-wingery. And that's why Maiden sleeves and Eddie becomes this flag-shagging thing. The Union Jack is often on Maiden product, whether it's terrible, awful wallets in shops called Fantasy and Reality or Trooper Beer. You know, they're like the UKIP of metal. Ooh, yes. And beyond beyond the politics, just sonically, you know, there's often this thing, you know, Maiden or Priest, and I love Priest, right? And unlike Priest, who they're often contrasted and compared to, Maiden just don't groove. They can only gallop. That's all they can do. They have this sort of giddy up kind of rhythm to their music, which really reflects that this is metal now entirely shorn of the sort of blues or black music influences that fed into bands like Zeppelin and Sabbath.
So that the Smiths of metal.
There's something to that. There's definitely something to that. You could argue it was Priest that really birthed heavy metal by melding kind of prog with heavy rock and these sort of heavily arpeggiated twin guitars that are kind of a signal, if you like. But Priest, how can I put it? They always just had plenty of arse to their sound. They always had a groove. Maiden are all about the treble and the kind of detail, and they're much more engaged with kind of proving their chops in a really entirely sort of European, almost classical kind of way. It leaves me cold. And it's perfect for metal boys. And you know, Maiden exclude women in all kinds of ways, not only from their audience, but also from their music. But it's perfect for metal boys to feel, because, you know, the metal boys want to feel that metal is the best music, because, you know, to play an instrument that fast, etc. But if you're out of metal subculture and you're aware of pop in any way, Maiden feel really cold and undanceable. They're kind of headbangable, but not danceable. And consequently, at the time, you know, in the 80s, among my few friends, Maiden were the band clung to by the most sort of squalid of my friends. How can I put it? The friends who made swords and played D&D and that. And you know, and even back then, those guys, I gave a wide berth to because they kind of stank and I didn't want to get nicks and stuff. So it's that side of metal. And finally, I mean, really, awful, awful front men for Maiden. And you know, the front man is kind of decides whether you like a band or not quite often. You know, I mean, the first singer, benefits cheap Paul Di'Anno, he was a nasty piece of work. And his lyrics, I mean, if you dig into lyrics for Killers or Murders in the Rue Morgue, you know, they show a really appalling attitude to women and violence against women. And beyond that, Di'Anno's a total fantasist. I mean, there's a fantastic quote from Di'Anno in Michael Hand's Oral History of Nwobbaham, Denim and Leather, where he's recalling one of Maiden's early shows at the Music Machine. And he goes, you know, the direct quote, he goes, we went up there and we had Kate Bush up on stage with us. I remember that. I was seeing her at the time.
Oh my God.
He's like the Aldridge Pryor hopeless liar. I mean, to Michael Hand's credit, he swiftly follows that quote up with a quote from Murray Charmer, Kate Bush's PR, which just flatly says, you know, Kate doesn't know that guy and has never been on stage at the Music Machine. And then there's a good quote straight after as well from Malcolm Dome, which says, you know, it didn't happen. I was there. It didn't happen. But I think he genuinely believes the stuff he comes out with. He lives in a fantasy world to some extent. Ooh. So, you know, there's Diarno problems. Dickinson is just this awful Brexit sort of Top Gear adjacent cunt, isn't he? And the thing is, with the other and the Wobbeham bands, the front men were really...
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Key in those bands' appeal, I think, you know, whether it's Saxon's Bill Bifford sort of being just dead funny, or just the magnificent Rob Halford, you know, that these guys are hilariously kind of unembarrassable and lovable because of it. And it's kind of wonderful that these people, who are essentially fans of glam rock, really became stars. Whereas with Maiden, from the moment they started, there's just this feel of management and business really guiding them to the top. That they're signed in the early days, because when EMI comes see them play in the middle of a bill that also included White Spirit and Angel Witch, Maiden, for that show, they knew that EMI were coming, and they bought tons of pyro, and they kind of secured that record deal. There's something cold and calculating about Maiden. You know, the band themselves, when they used to get on their leathers and their kind of clothes and spandex and stuff, they used to call dressing up for the shows getting on the cunt kit. And getting on the cunt kit. And I think that kind of, it's funny, but it kind of reveals something about them and their attitude to their audience. So for all those reasons, I kind of proudly state fuck Maiden and fuck Dickinson and fuck this kind of sexless, grooveless BO rock. In 1984, I mean, Simon's mentioned the big four, you know, the big four thrash bands swinging. That was where I was listening to metal. And really the major impact Maiden had in my life in 85 was probably, I mean, this is 3 years short of Nico McBrain's drum battle with Sooty, don't forget. you know, their major impact is them soundtracking, you know, Daily Thompson, I'm going to swig a Lucozade.
Oh, yes!
In the advert.
No! No, 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 no!
Indeed. Voiced by fellow Brexiteer, you know, Des Lynam. So, yeah, no, fuck Maiden, man.
Metal and athletics, man. They're not two things you'd naturally put together.
No, not at all. I mean, later on in the noughties, of course, we do get a kind of sports metal.
Ugh.
Horrific.
Yes.
But, yeah, no, at this period, no. I mean, yeah, the metal fans were the guys at the back of the cross country, you know. They're
yes.
walking with some soap bar on the go or something. You know?
Yes.
I got someone I want to ask, Neil. In fact, it's kind of a question. Oh, by the way, the police are on their way. Don't you worry about that for your break-in. yeah, what it is, it's a question in two parts. Don't you fucking hate it when someone does that, by the way, a Q&A? It's like, a question in two parts. The only thing worse than that is if they say, not so much a question, more of an observation. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, what is this? I said that, you know, metal in general and Maiden in particular are all about these sort of male power fantasies. Mm, and mm. you said yourself, you know, it's all about, it's boys, stinky boys into this. Your daughter loving this music is the kind of hole in my argument. And I wondered, and here's the two parts. First of all, how do you explain that? And secondly, when she started showing an interest in this kind of music, did you feel like a bit of a failure as a parent?
No, the thing is, right, I know sort of, you can't fail as a parent. I mean, I think as a parent, you just got to kind of let your kids get into what the fuck they want to get into, you know what I mean? Yeah. And not guide it in any way whatsoever. So it is thrilling when her...
And then cut them out of your will.
No, it's nice, you know, when their own reconnaissance sort of loops around with yours to a certain extent. But you're right, there is an odd thing, because not many, how can I put it, when she listens to stuff like Maiden, when she listens to songs like Murders in the Room or Go Killers, which are quite misogynistic in a way, I think the place she puts it in her head is purely alongside horror as a genre, both in literature and in film. So she's watching giallo movies, well, she is. She's watching horrifically violent shit, to be honest with you. You know, my daughter, when I walk in the front room, the telly suddenly goes muted and stops. Fuck only knows what she's watching. She's watching a lot of really gruesome shit. But I think she sees it as... It doesn't speak to her as a kind of like, you know, I want to go out and do that to women, or I want to go that out and be that violent. For her, it's kind of, in a sense, yeah, pure fantasy and just an evocation of violence. But yeah, it is problematic, because like the major thing that I always say in the car when she's punching my arm saying Maiden are great is, but they're so fucking Brexit. And that's important to her. She's like, no, they're not Brexit anymore. He's apologised. If she knows that, I don't know, a singer is right wing or a Trump supporter or doesn't agree with her politics, she rapidly falls out of love with that band. She's had to rationalise it in her head that Maiden, you know, aren't Brexit, Bruce has apologised, etc. you know, to be into it. So, yeah, I don't feel embarrassed that she's playing fucking Stormwitch or has convinced me of the value of the Scorpions. She's inspired much more by women in metal, I think, than she is by all the blokes.
As opposed to women in uniform!
Did Bruce Dickinson apologise, or did he just moan about the consequences of Brexit?
I think that was it. He said he moaned about its impact on touring bands, didn't he? So, I'm sticking to my guns. I don't care. She can keep giving me a dead arm. But those political problems haven't shoved Maiden out of her listening, because musically they appeal to her, I guess. But the groovelessness, it's a constant sticking point with me and Soph, that Kiss fucking suck and Maiden suck. And I will never, ever retract those opinions, because they're true. I think she'll grow out of them. I am.
And wasn't it totally unsurprising that about 20 years ago, when metal t-shirts became fashionable and were in Topshop, it was Iron Maiden?
Yeah, and it still is. You can still get Maiden t-shirts in places like Primark and stuff like that, because it's an instant signifier or something. But people... I've got to say, I mean, Maiden, of course, are still selling out big stadiums and stuff like that. But in terms of the records I'd still keep from that period, they're the worst. And you know, there's no place for women in their music. Maiden never sing love songs or sex songs. There's no place for sex in their music either, because the boys that they're appealing to are not having sex. So they don't want to hear about a frontman who is having sex. They want to hear about a frontman who is obsessed with their small, you know, wank sock world of warfare and horror movies and all of that. I always remember the boys that I used to teach. I used to teach them gaming. They used to want to be games designers.
Right.
They were horrible and hateful and kind of right wing. In that way that alternative culture has got a bit right-wing in recent years. But I always remember kind of stepping out of the room to go and have a fag and coming back to this room of these 10 metal boys. And fuck me, it just stank. I know that's a prejudice, and it's kind of a cliched prejudice.
But it's true.
But it's true. And teenage boys are pretty gruesome in whatever they're into. But that kind of horrible, squalid grubbiness of the fans of Maiden in particular, it's an undeniable truism, I think, and it percolates into their music. Priest For instance, as another metal band of the period, they're writing really quite interesting songs. You can hear Halford, you know, having to cover up his gayness, so that songs like Breaking the Law, etc., are kind of reflective of something really, really interesting. Whereas Maiden are just unproblematically telling little boys that, yeah, their tiny penises matter, and you know, women are all bitches, etc. So it's kind of unretrievable.
Yeah.
Although, you know, the horned hand and all of the other Americanized kind of aspects of metal culture now seem to be dragging everything back into the fold. In terms of their influence on other metal bands, yes, of course you're going to hear most metal people saying, "Yeah, Maiden were important." But in terms of their influence, I don't hear it much in modern metal. To be honest with you,
a teenage dirtbag.
Well,
you weren't listening to Judas Priest.
No. But I mean, yeah, in that particular war, Priest win hands down. And Maiden are this grooveless kind of, you know, the way Alan Freeman used to pepper his kind of show, this Friday rock show, with flourishes of classical music. Maiden are very much on that side of things. They've got no groove because they're not really coming from a heavy rock background, by which I mean something that's informed at least tangentially by R&B or something. They're coming purely, they listen to Lizzy, they listen to these widdly bands, and all they got was the whiddle. They didn't listen to the groove underneath it.
I feel really grateful to Neil for this. I feel like he's kind of sort of fastidiously dissected and examined this enormous great turd, you know, which I just sort of like flushed from my kind of...
He's the Gillian McKeith of chart music.
Yes.
No, you know, we've said in the past that everything ends at rehabilitated. We've had discussions in the past that, you know, why is Toto's Africa now considered a classic?
Oh, God,
it's this thing that the passage of time happens, and because those old things that people are into are just sort of charming and quaint, they end up getting rehabilitated. But Maiden should not be rehabilitated. Their music's dreadful. I mean, it always was.
Yeah.
And you know, I knew this as a child. I knew this even when Number of the Beast came out. I thought, how dare you exploit Omen for your for your mercenary ends? So yeah, no, a cold, calculating, and somewhat unmoving band, Maiden. You are not wrong to dislike them.
Good.
Thank you.
So, the following week, Running Free would only manage a one-place jump to number 19, its highest position. The follow-up, a live version of Run to the Hills, became the Christmas number 26, while Live After Death entered the LP chart at number 2, held off the summit of Albumburg by Love Songs by George Benson on KTEL. And of course, the original version was used to devastating effect as the soundtrack to the Maiden Minute in Bed with Chris Needham, where Manslaughter take time out from the stress of being Loughborough's top-ranked thrash metal band by running down a school corridor, wrapping sellotape round Chris's little brother's head, and filming themselves having a big waz into a toilet. Hello! We're drinking! Thank you very much, Neil. See you down the line, brother.
No, we're totally good.
See you, Neil.
Bye. Neil's being ejected from the premises. I think it's a good time to stop there, catch his breath, and come back hard tomorrow for part 3 of Chart Music 72. So, on behalf of David Stubbs and Simon Price, this is Al Needham asking you nice to stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.
Hey, pop craze youngster! Do you love chart music but hate London? Do you want to see our new live show but would sooner stop at home and doss about in your pants on a Saturday? Are you going to our live show but want to see it again and again and again and again for a week or so? Well, it seems to me like you need to get booked into our live stream at this year's London Podcast Festival. See that keyboard, use those fingers, mash out tinyurl.com/cmlive23, all lowercase, step up to the pay window, lay your money down and get ready ready to see Team ATV Land throw down live and direct on Saturday, September the 16th. That link again, tinyurl.com/cmlive23, all lower case. Come on, pop craze youngsters, stick that money down this G-string and watch Team ATV Land grind and thrust just for you. No wanking though, okay?